Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is episode number 8 of the Driving Eureka podcast. The podcast is structured around Doug Hall's newsletter at doughall.com, and you can find all the archive newsletters under the heading Newsletters from the main menu. This week's feature story is the end of Big Bang innovation. The Driving Eureka book segment answers the question, why do patents matter? And in the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy, we'll discuss the classic cocktail, the martini. Well, let's talk about our featured story for this week. The Big Bang Theory, it's a show that I love. Big Bang Theory is very popular for people with Sheldon and Leonard and the gang. But I don't think that's what you're talking about here.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. It's a fine TV show. But well, the thing that doesn't work for me is corporations have this view that innovation is about a big bang. And in 40 years of doing this, I've never seen it happen. The premise is if we just come up with this big bang idea, you know, we go on the roof of our office, sit in a lotus position, wait for the lightning to strike us. And we get this big idea and tell people to do it, then a miracle occurs. Hmm. And the truth of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, at best, 10% of the initial idea is what you're going to realize at the end of the day. The idea is worth just 10%. 90% of it lies in the hard work you put in during the journey from idea to reality. And the consultants, speakers, and authors who I ran against who preach but have never practiced innovation perpetuate this. They say the front end, you got to invest in the front end. You need to do all of the stuff at the beginning and insights and design and all of this stuff. And then they claim victory that they've got this magical idea. And then you're stuck with it to try to figure out how to actually ship it.
So is this the big idea hunt that you talk about?
Well, it's related to that. Okay. It's related to that. It's after you've gotten it and you say, oh, look, a miracle's occur. We got it. The gurus gave us this magical idea. But the fact of the matter is that's not – you got to do more than that. Hmm. You got to do more than that. It's taking it from there because two separate studies show that companies lose half the value of an idea is lost during the development. Because people end up compromising. They compromise the ideas. They say, well, we can't do this. We can't do this. And next thing you know, the idea isn't worth doing, but they've got so much time into it, they just go ahead anyways, which is just madness. It's madness.
You know, this kind of brings up, it's somewhat related. It's maybe a touch off of the subject, but, you know, I constantly read about people tracking trends for innovation. You know, that's the way to innovate is to track trends. What's your stand on that? What's your thinking with regards to things that are trending in certain industries?
Well, trends are fine. We call it future mining. My problem with some trends is that they're rear view mirror looking. In other words, look, two other companies are making a lot of money in this. That's a trend. Let's go do it now. Now we're the third one in with the same old crap as everybody else, and the only place left is cheap. Hmm. As opposed to taking those things and doing future mining and building scenarios as to what could happen in the future. If you're not careful with trends, you just become a follower. And the research is clear. You're going to make a fraction of the profits of the leader. I mean, that's the data. I mean, you can say you don't like it and you can say, well, there was this example. Yeah, sure. There was an example. Just like when the weatherman says there's a 90% chance of rain. Well, 10% of the time you have to get the reverse because that's what 90% means. It doesn't mean 100%. The fact of the matter is that you want to be anticipating the future and driving it. And so future mining is good, but it's not enough because the marketplace changes, ideas change, and you've got to be able to pivot and adjust. But it all gets back to your system for going from idea to reality. And you got to get that built into the DNA of your organization.
And is it because organizations don't have something in place, or it's informal?
No, there is no system. There's no system.
Okay.
The system is it's management by metric. To get through the gate, you have to have these numbers. You have to have the gate. You have to have these. And well, okay. But that doesn't tell you how to do it. There's no mindset for doing it. And in fact, you've got 3/4 of the organization in support groups whose job it is to prevent risk at all causes. I just got a request from a big academic book to write a chapter on innovation and product development, and which is, you know, I don't know if I'm probably going to do it. I don't know. We'll see. But it was interesting. Their questions, they said, can you give me the arc of the story of what's gone on in innovation? And I'll tell you what happened is that everything was fine. The world got going faster. People had to go faster. People started to come up with ideas. They had to failure. They then put in a system. The aim of the system was to prevent a failure from ever happening. And that system tends to be a gated system. It came from NASA originally. Then a professor named it StageGate. And the idea was gates of inspection. You see where I'm going?
Yeah.
We're gonna measure the quality. We're gonna inspect the quality as we produce the car, 1950s Ford and Chevy. And what did that do? That didn't create quality. No, it creates gaming of the system. Guess what happens with a stage gate system? You game the system. It's madness. It's absolute madness. It's guaranteed to not work. That's why you have a 95% failure rate at corporations, because the system, stupid, is not designed to do it. And you say, well, you're being – it's management by objective. No, it's not. When Drucker set up management by objective, it was not to be a number. It was management by strategic goal that you were doing, not numerology.
You know, it's interesting.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No.
You got me ranting.
Well,
now.
No, but that's okay because, well, even with the, you know, that was the thing with Deming. Deming really came down on management by objectives with Drucker, and Drucker clarified himself and said the way it's being practiced is not what I intended. It's completely gone to, you know, to the Milky Way. So there's a very wide misconception, and unfortunately, it seems like everybody's doing the wrong thing when they're using the management by objectives that Drucker intended when he wrote it, and it's perpetuated by business schools. So they're in essence perpetuating this thinking that's very Tayloristic. So Frederick Taylor, you know, in the early 1900s, it's a different world now. It's basically going from Newton to Einstein, so we're in a different universe, and the companies are still operating in the old one. Now I'm not real familiar with the stage gate portion. Is it something that's widely used in corporations?
Yeah, about 85% of companies.
So these would be large companies, I assume.
Yeah, large companies, 85% use it. And by the way, there were two Robert Coopers who worked on it. One was a business person, one was a professor, the Robert E. and Robert C. or something like that. And I met the business person, and it was supposed to increase speed and decrease risk. But because there were not the systems put in place and how to do the work, then, you know, it's worked. Now then what they've done is, see – when you put these systems in, what happened is people have turned around and blamed the front end. Well, if we had a better idea, our system for development is fine. If we just had a better idea.
Okay.
And so they're now focusing on what they call stage zero, the beginning, you know, the fuzzy front end. And I was part of that. I was part of that for a long time with Eureka Inventing. But I'm telling you, it's the wrong place. You know, that's not where the problem is. The problem is when you try to take that wicked cool idea and make it into reality, that's where the problem is. That's where all the mess is.
So let me ask this. You guys for years did kind of the big idea piece at the Eureka Ranch, and you're saying, you know, that's only 10% of it. What got you, what was the trigger that made you realize that, you know, we're not really getting anywhere here because, or the companies aren't, because they're taking the ideas and killing them off with their, you know, we've talked about this before, the bureaucracy or, you know, other things that are involved in their culture or system. What was it? What was the trigger that sent you down this path? Yeah, yeah.
For me, what drove me crazy was wasting my life. You know, they'd pay us good money. We'd invent this big idea. I kid you not. We'd invent this. They'd give us a ridiculous objective that was impossible to do. We invent patentable breakthroughs. Miracle has occurred. And then they F it up. And not because the people want to, but because the system screws it up. The system kills it. And then they get to the end and they come back. And the worst part of this for me was they never blamed us. They said, yeah, we messed it up. Here, can you give me some more? And when you've been doing this for 40 years, you go, I've seen this movie. Okay?
I poked my eye. Can you poke my other eye out?
Okay. Yeah, do it again. And this company's that I've done 20 and 30 projects for. This is amazing. It is amazing. And you tell people it's your system, it's bad. They go, we're no worse than anybody else. I go, that's right. You're no stupider than all the other stupid people. Fix the system. The people want to do quality work. They want to do something good. They want to do something amazing. And we've robbed them of the pride of work to be able to do something. We've taken all of this effort. And you know what it's like when you have an impossible mission and then you accomplish it and then you see it just get flushed? That really, really is horrific. It just is terrible. It's terrible.
Was it across the board, Doug? I mean, you worked with a lot of big companies. I mean, you know, we've talked about Disney and Nike and different companies like that.
It's everywhere.
It was. Okay. So it wasn't just
these big, it's mostly with big companies. At smaller companies, it's not as bad. It's not as bad with smaller companies, but with these others, it's just a mess. It's just a mess.
Very interesting. Okay. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book excerpt with legendary inventor Doug Hall. Why do patents matter? And this is kind of a big deal. And I've never really thought about it until I started working with you guys about the patents and how important that they really are. And now we're seeing a whole, I think the awareness level, I think in the U.S. now is peaked. I mean, we've got this whole thing going on with China and IP and those types of things. Any commentary on that? Because now all of a sudden people are interested in intellectual property. And what does that mean? And what do you mean, Micron Technology lost, you know, $8.6 billion because they had their IP stolen?
Yeah. I'd like to think that they actually cared about it, but the reality is they don't. These are all reactionary examples. So forget everything you're hearing in the news. It's a whole pile of bunk, because the reality is that the patent laws have been changed to make them more powerful and more helpful to us. And patents should be expanding, but there are more patents going to companies and to people from outside the U.S. than in the U.S. In other words, born in the USA, invented in the USA, continues to go down as a percentage of the patents filed. So we have a serious problem of patent illiteracy going on right now.
Mm.
And we have a true false test on basic patent knowledge. 50% would be guessing, and the average executive gets 60%. And they'll give you every story in the world. Well, patents aren't worthwhile. In our category, they don't matter. Well, here's the reality. The reality is that what research shows is that companies where they file patents make higher margin and the employees get paid more money. But other than that, they don't really matter, because a patent is a government-supported monopoly. Now, Is it the giant wall that ends all things? No. But you got to understand it. But I talk to executives and I ask, well, what do you get patented? Well, yeah, we have a patent on that. And I'm like, on what? On that. On what part of that? Well, no, it's just you can't make that. I said, what part can I? They don't even understand it. I then go and I'm sitting in front of 24 engineering deans and I say, who teaches your engineering students what's patentable? Not a single hand goes up. Now, I can tell you, Tripp, you can maybe guess by the tone of my voice, I then went ballistically crazy.
Not you, Doug.
And they said, and one person said, the accreditation bodies don't require it. I said, then the accreditation bodies are crap. Crap. I go to business school. I said, are you interested in helping people make more money? Oh, yes. Money is important. Yes, money is important. Yes, want to make higher margins. Oh, yes, want to do that. Finance is important. Yes, finance is important. Okay. Do you understand what is patentable and what is not and be able to evaluate a patent? What are you talking about? No, that's not our job. That's engineering's job. No, I already talked to them. They said it's not their job either. So, I mean, for crying out loud, we're doing all of this work to do strategic thinking. Strategic thinking on how to get an advantage. And the one thing that matters more than anything else is intellectual property. It's 70% to 80% of the valuation of companies intellectual property. The factories are easy. I can rent those. I can borrow those. I can find those all over the world. It's the thinking where all the value is. Patents are critical. My view is if you work for me on a project, you hire us to do an reinventing, and if I'm helping out with it, the right rule is really simple. No patent, no project. No patent, no project. Because a patent means your idea. Here's the simple definition. A patent is when you have a element of it, a claim, that is something that you're going to do that is non-obvious to somebody with ordinary skill in the industry. So let me say it the reverse way. If what your new idea is obvious to somebody with ordinary skill, then your idea is not patentable, and it doesn't sound like much of an innovation to me.
So, Doug, what about the whiskey business and patents?
Well, fair point. So you're checking on me, aren't you, Tripp? I can see this. I can see this. Yeah. You're tripping to make sure that I'm following. I'm doing this rant, but am I doing it myself? Well, the whiskey business, as it turns out, until very recently, had very, very few patents because you've got an industry that is basically there's three big conglomerates that own most of the bourbons and most of the scotch, and they all kind of work together. I'm not saying they illegally work together, but they cooperate. They buy barrels back and forth from each other, and some of this is very good, and some of it is less good, in my mind, for innovation. And so they don't file a lot of patents. But with the whiskey business, because I'm putting my money into it, because I put my money on the table for it, my time, energy, and money, no patent, no project. And so patents have been a major piece of the work here. And for the first year, we're now getting into our third year here now. For the first year, I would probably say 70% of our time was on perfecting the technology and the patents, doing it. And so and in a future episode, we can go into that in more depth because we've got some that are public and some that are not public. And obviously, I don't want to talk about the ones that are not public that are still secret but that are in the process. But we can talk about them. But it's a critical thing. And what I like about working on patents is it forces the team to think differently. You can't just do the same old stuff and get a patent. You have to think differently. You've got to break the rules. They only give patents to crazy people. And in fact, at one point, because if you're normal, if you're adult, you're mature, it's obvious, it's no good. I told my guys, I took the old Apple thing. I said, some call us the crazy ones, and we're okay with that. because that's the only people that get patents.
So, but the prudent ones aren't allowed then, right?
What's that?
The prudent ones aren't allowed.
No prudent. Practical will not get you a patent.
Okay.
It will not get you a patent.
You touch upon this, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but are they not, they being these distilleries, the large ones, are they not patenting things because they're just trade secrets that they have or how, what's the?
Well, I to be perfectly honest, I don't know that they're even actually trade secrets in most cases, because most of the people in the industry know pretty much everything that's going on. Just asked a few folks. No, I think part of it is that the big companies in all industries, not just whiskey, tend to get to a recipe for a product. And they make the same product that way all the time. And so they make little tweaks on it, but they don't really invent original stuff. You know, I mean, when was the last time you had a remarkably different whiskey? You know, I mean, you may get an expensive one or a cheap one, a smooth one or a harsh one. But how many times do you taste something where you go, oh, my God, that's like nothing else? It's not often.
No.
It's not often.
No. So is this kind of the situation, you know, and let's just shift a little bit into talking about service industry here. Now, well, you've seen this. I mean, the biggest tidal wave I've seen is obviously Amazon. I mean, they completely changed the way that they've done. And my understanding is, and maybe you know more about this than me, Doug, but is they filed a ton of patents on stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're very aggressive with it. I mean, most internet companies, most of these things are in it. Now, whether or not you want to enforce, whether or not you complete, these are separate questions. But filing for them is done very aggressively. We'll on some future episodes, we'll give some more hints on ways to work this. And the Driving Eureka book's got a whole bunch more concepts in it. And in fact, the price of the book alone, it's worth it to get the quiz in there for the patent literacy test, because it'll really it's going to shake you up when you realize what you didn't know you didn't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, we want to put that into the show notes on the website so people have access to that. I think we definitely want to be able to do that so they can kind of know. You got to know what you don't know, you know? So and I don't know that people are aware. I and again, just what I said at the beginning, whatever politics that you're in, this whole fight with China over intellectual property, I think has got people's attention about patents and things they never really thought about before.
Well, but we have to be careful what we ask for. There is a very, very good chance that, you know, China's view is that they are a developing nation, you know, because they have so many, you know, people and poverty and that kind of stuff that they can't afford to do it. But if they were to start, they've gone on a rampage filing patents. Remember, patents are by country, and a lot of U.S. companies have ignored filing in China. And if you haven't filed in China, you can't complain about them copying. Okay, so because that's the way the rules are. And there's a lot of – I've seen that before. People say, well, I can't believe it. They did it in China. I said, did you file in China? No. I said, well, then they're not breaking the law. Yeah, but the China patents are no good there. Well, wait a minute. You can't have it both ways. And so we're going to end up in a situation where freedom to practice in China, companies aren't going to get their products manufactured there because they're going to be violating a Chinese patent. So this is not as simple a story as you hear. Are there some gross examples? Absolutely, positively. But if you start to track these things down and you start to track some of the stuff that the people are doing, it's a more complex story. And I am not an expert at this, but this is going to be more complex than you think, because you're going to end up wandering over to China. You're going to say, well, what do you mean I can't manufacture my product? And they say, well, you're going to violate a Chinese patent. They said, but that's not reasonable. And it's like, well, but it is, because they were filing. Now, how good they are, how good the examination is, lots more issues to this. There's a lot more to this conversation than the simple sound bites that you're hearing, that they're stealing stuff. It's probably fair to say that the vast majority of the stuff that they're, quote, stealing is they're just reading the patent literature, and the companies weren't smart enough to file over there or didn't care enough to do it because management was illiterate on it. And, you know, so they lost it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, yeah. Well, it is what it is. It's just – but it has drawn more attention. My broader point was – it's drawn more attention to this particular piece. And I'll be honest with you, before I met you, patents were not at the front of my mind. I never really thought about it. And then, you know, once you start introducing how important it is, and you know, being able to figure out how to make something patentable as far as a product or a service, it, you know, just the awareness of it changes how you think about it. And I think that's the issue that we're fighting here, it doesn't matter whether you're an engineer or something else. So yeah. Doing Polaroids there?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. Let's move out of patents for now. I mean, I'm sure we're going to revisit that a number of times as time goes by.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we're going to take you behind the scenes on what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company like has never been done before.
The Brain Brew Whiskey Academy, a martini worthy of celebrating 85 years since Prohibition. And I got, you know, Doug, that's my drink. So I'm not quite as probably detailed as you are around the knowledge.
Well, this is one where I am prudent and proper.
Oh no. Oh no. Well, I'm prudent and proper, but I, you know, the thing I like, Doug, and you, I don't know, this may make your eyes roll, but I got it for the first time at Sullivan's restaurant here in Indy, but they had a dirty martini with blue cheese stuffed olives, and ever since then, I will not drink a martini without blue cheese stuffed olives. So I'll let you take it from there.
Well, and that's fine. That's nice. No, I mean, I would and dirty martinis, you know, it was 85 years ago on December 5th, 1933, Prohibition ended. And FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was going to get rid of it. And he loved martinis, and he preferred a dirty martini like you do, okay? But I am, in this case, even though I love all these different things, when it comes to martinis, I am an absolute fanatic about martinis, and actually all cocktails. And it doesn't help that I'm a chemical engineer and I'm into rapid cycles of testing. And I've got some friends, and I mentioned in the newsletter, I mentioned Tim, John, and Sheldon, who know who they are. Fortunately are just as compulsive as I, with regards to making martinis. And I have gone through a ridiculous, I mean, it would be, hundreds of tests on this. And in fact, just the other night I found another gin and I said, well, let me try this one. And I tried it three ways. Oh, nope. Didn't beat the classic. So this is in the show notes. If you're driving, don't worry about that. You can get it there. And this is precision. So here's the way this works. You got to do it exactly, precisely as I say. I mean, and I'm talking precision here. Now, after that, you can do your riffs. But if you want to learn jazz, you got to learn to play the scales first. Are you hearing me here now? You got to do it precise. And once you can play the scales well, then you can start doing your riffs on it. Okay, so here we go. Now, there's a little bit of details to this. Okay, so step one, you're going to fill a martini glass with water and ice to chill it while you make the drink, okay? And this is important because otherwise when you put the cold martini in, the thermodynamics are the cold goes into the glass. So you're going to let that sit while you're putting it together. Step two, you're going to get a classic Boston shaker. That's the type that has the, you know, the cup and the two cups that go together, like you see bartenders use. Not what's called the cobbler type, where you have the little strainer thing on the top.
Okay.
The difference is that with the Boston shaker, you get a longer throw. Okay, so the ice bangs around more, and it gets to the perfect dilution. And all of my recipe is built around doing it out of that shaker.
And does the shaker have to be made out of something in particular? I'm sure there's different.
Yeah, it's usually metal and glass is what you usually use.
Okay.
Is what they normally are.
All right.
And so now I know that I am a shaken, not stirred martini drinker. And there are people that are of the stirred camp, not me. Okay. I like the cold and I like the ice crystals. I think it gives it a zing. versus the clear, which I call practical and prudent stirred version of martinis. Don't want to do that. Okay. So you got your Boston shaker. You fill it with ice. Now, to the ice, you're going to add 2 ounces of Beef Eater gin. Now, don't be arguing with me here. Do it. You got to get the Beef Eater. I know it doesn't cost like a stupid amount of money, but it is the world standard. I talked with a guy once who got his PhD, and his thesis was around gin, and he told me, he said, Beef Eater is the standard that everything is measured against, and it is truly dry. Sadly, today, many of the gins, the reason why people like them is they can, you can legally add sugar to them, and they've got sugar added to them. You know, it's nuts. You know, they'll have 1% and 2% sugar. I mean, we measure it. You can pick it up. And that's what the vermouth is for, is to add the little sweetness. So if you add vermouth on top of some of these modern gins, it's stupid. It doesn't work. So you've added 2 ounces of Beef Eater. And I'm not going to give you an option for an ounce and a half on this one trip. You got to do 2 ounces, okay? Okay? I'm just telling you how to make it right. Uh-huh. Then you're going to get Dolin dry vermouth. It's the green bottle. And you're going to get Dolin. You're not going to use the others. You're going to use Dolin because that's the best. And then you're going to take the cap off it. You're going to buy the half-size bottle, the 375, and you're going to keep it in the refrigerator because it goes bad. You go to these bars, and they got the vermouth sitting there. It's freaking oxidized. It's horrible. And so you only want to buy a half-size bottle. And if you can get the little ones, that's even better because freshness is going to matter here. You're going to take the cap off, and you're going to pour the vermouth into the cap, the screw cap that comes off it, and that's how much vermouth you're going to use.
Ah.
Okay?
Okay.
I learned that from Harry's Bar in Venice, Florida. In Venice, Italy. Capful. Now you're going to shake the martini for 12 seconds. You can use your watch or count 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. And yes, I mean 12 seconds.
It's not 13 seconds? You got to be consistent,
12
Doug.
12 seconds. I told you, 12 seconds. I know it's different, but that's the way it is. 12 seconds. And what that does is the ice starts to chill, and the liquid hits the maximum cold in 12 seconds. After that, it starts to just dilute, and you're not going to get any colder. Okay. Then you're going to dump the ice water from your martini glass, and you're going to use what's called a Hawthorne strainer. And the Hawthorne strainer makes it so that you can strain it out, and it's got the little curly things on it, but you can look it up and you'll see what it is. And you're going to strain that in, and now you got 3 choices. You can add 2 olives, a thin piece of lemon peel, wiping it on the rim, or go crazy and do both. Now, I switch it up. You know, like in the summertime, sometimes I'll do the lemon. But most of the time, it's 2 olives. And then you need to sit down. You don't stand to drink this drink. This is a sitting drink. You sit there, and you hold the martini glass, and you look at the little ice shards that are there because you shook it. And then you slowly take it, and you take a sip, and hold it in your mouth for a second. And then it's like, ah, my God, is there a, you know, it's spectacular. It's spectacular.
So my only question, Doug, is where's the Kettle One vodka that you do in the martini?
Well, that would not be, in my mind, proper martini. I told you how to make the best martini. If you're going to do vodka in the – I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there because there's people out there that like to have their vodka. I'm talking about a truly proper martini that is just magnificent. I'm telling you. All my buddies, Tim, John, and Sheldon, they go, well, I like martinis. I like a gin and tonic. For Christ's sake, gin and tonic, freaking soda. Why don't you have a rum and Coke for crying out loud? I mean, it's just, just a sugar pill with a little bit of gin, and you can't even taste the gin anymore. Well, I don't like, well, then don't drink gin. You know, just drink vodka or something.
So who damaged you with this formula? Where'd you get so stuck on this thing?
Well, because I got into it and I started doing it and I ordered them, and I would love them and hate them. And now I'm at the point where I can't even order them at bars. I can't even order bars because they're just horrific. The vermouth is usually cheap vermouth that's oxidized, that's horrific to begin with.
Ah.
And they take a sugar pill craft gin that's got sugar and they put it in, and it's just concoctions that are just worthless. So it's just not worth getting. Harry's Bar in Venice, right around from the big cathedral there on the square, St. Mark's, is a spectacular there. They make a proper martini, and that's where some of this recipe came from, spending maybe some time with the bartender there.
Okay. All right. Well, that's I've never heard you so adamant about you have to follow this step by step. I was looking through here.
Usually there's a lot of flexibility to it. You know, make it to your taste. I'm just telling you, make it this way. Mm. Exactly. And I think you'll become a convert. Then after that, do whatever you want. Make it exactly this way. All right. And I think you'll be amazed. And those people who don't like a martini are going to say, my God, I have seen the light, brothers and sisters. I've seen the light.
And they may be saying that after three anyway. So
this is the thing. I can't imagine in the 50s they would make a pitcher of martinis. I can't even imagine the concept.
Oh,
why
my God.
Would.
Oh,
it just
no.
Doesn't even make any sense to me. But
all right. Well, that concludes our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy for this week.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.